My name is Tom Pelton. I'm with the Environmental Integrity Project. We're a nonprofit organization that was founded 20 years ago that is dedicated to enforcing environmental laws and strengthening public policy to protect public health and the environment. And today we're releasing a new report, The Clean Water Act at 50, Promises Half Kept at the Half Century Mark. We're gonna have a presentation by speakers today, and then we're gonna open it up to questions from reporters. So our first speaker is going to be Eric Schaefer, the executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project and the former director of civil enforcement at EPA. Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you, Tom, and welcome everyone. Thanks for joining us today. So this year we mark the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act of 1972. It's hard to believe it's been that long. We want to remind everyone the law promised fishable and swimmable waters by 1983, and it was going to eliminate the discharge of all pollutants to all navigable waterways by 1985. We're not there yet, obviously. It's inspiring to see that, you know, people used to dream big. And we hope that we can recommit ourselves to this law and finish the work that the 1972 Act started. You might have to be as old as I am to understand how bad it used to be before we had the Clean Water Act. When I was a teenager in the late 60s growing up in suburban Virginia, you could smell the Potomac River pretty much all the time in the summer. The White House used to have to close all the doors and windows whenever international visitors came through. You had the Cahoga and Rouge Rivers in the Midwest, so full of crud that people used to say it didn't flow, it oozed. And it oozed so much oil and grease that it caught fire, famously, and those photographs made their way around the world. And our sewage treatment plants were primitive. Industries dumped almost unlimited amounts of pollution anywhere they wanted to. That was the reality in the late 60s. And things have changed for the better since then. There's no doubt. The Potomac River is now a major bass fishery. You can actually canoe down the Cahoga River. But we don't have the fishable swimmable waters that we were promised. And we have more work to do before we get them. Before I get to our findings, here's the basic framework of that law, which is still in place. First, the US EPA had to set minimum standards that limited the discharge of pollutants from public wastewater treatment plants and from industry all across the US. So the idea was to set a floor, require everyone to meet minimum standards if you were in these regulated categories. We're talking here about big wastewater treatment plants, public and industrial. You had to meet minimum standards no matter where you did business, anywhere in the country. Second, of course, Congress and then the states as well and cities poured billions of dollars into wastewater treatment plants. We got major, major upgrades. I think if you put all the money together and adjust it for inflation, upwards of $1 trillion, thinking about the funding from all the sources. So really a major, major commitment. But we're going to focus on a third aspect of the law today, and that's one that required states to evaluate the condition of their rivers, streams, lakes, and bays and estuaries, and decide whether they were safe for swimming or other contact recreation, or healthy enough to support fish and other aquatic life. And if the answer to any of these questions was no, and there are several more that are related, if the answer to any of these questions was no, then the waters were designated impaired, just a fancy way of saying too polluted, and states with EPA riding herd on them were supposed to set and enforce targets for cleaning them up. So based on the latest round of those state reviews, you can see how much work remains in front of us. We had 1.4 million miles of streams and rivers assessed by the 50 states. We have data for most of them. We're missing data for a couple that we just couldn't find. 1.4 million nationwide, more than 700,000, just over half, not meeting water quality standards, either because they are too dirty to support aquatic life, or because they're unsafe for swimming, or for both. You can be designated because you failed to meet several standards. About 55% of our lakes, more than 11 million acres, also falling short, and just about a quarter of our bays, estuaries, and harbors, although that I think that's probably an undercount because there's some data missing in that last category. But in any case, hundreds of thousands of river and stream miles, millions of acres of lakes, and tens of thousands of square miles of bays and estuaries not meeting standard. So that data, it's important to say, is based on the waters that have been assessed in the last few years. There are a lot of holes in that particular part of the safety net. So more than three quarters of the rivers and streams that are on the map and exist haven't been evaluated at all in the last few years. And so we don't really know what their condition is. But what we do know tells us at least half of the ones that were looked at aren't meeting standard. So there are, we provided some information about states and which ones have seem to have particularly serious problems. We need to look at this understanding the caveats. So for example, we see Oregon has more than 112,000 miles of rivers and streams that are impaired, not meeting water quality standards. At first glance, that seemed like Oregon, why would they have so much more than any other state? Well, it turns out that 90,000 of those river and stream miles are impaired because they are overheated. They've gotten too warm to support aquatic and fish life. And that's a variety of reasons for that, but climate change is obviously a major factor. And that's going to be an issue that we're dealing with going forward. You've got Indiana, more than 24,000 miles of rivers and streams that you can't swim in or have any contact with. That's the highest in the country. Why so high? Well, you know, they've got a big animal feedlot sector, as well as discharges from sewages and streams creating that problem. But to give credit to the state, they actually looked harder at their rivers and streams and assessed more of them than most other states. I think about 68% of the rivers and streams on the map in Indiana were actually evaluated. And many states, it's more like a quarter or even less, even got looked at. So this is an area where the more you look, the more you're going to find. And it's just important to recognize that. We've got for lakes, I'm not sure they're on this list because it's focused on rivers and streams. Florida, the Sunshine State, has nearly 900,000 acres unfit for human consumption. And I'm sorry, unfit for swimming and aquatic life. Primarily algae and bacteria driving those problems. So then last but not least, we've got California, a state that always seems thirsty, but you have 37,000 miles there that are so polluted, the water isn't functioning well as a source of drinking water because it takes so much money to get the pollutants out and make that water drinkable. So what's causing all this pollution? You can probably think about three primary categories. We have nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. And those will, together, they'll drive algae growth. They take oxygen out of the water. They make waterways really uninhabitable for aquatic life and also pretty gross to swim in. So that's a problem that's probably gotten worse since the 70s, and I'll come back to that. You've got bacteria. Whenever you see limits on the ability of people to swim in the water, bacteria is usually the culprit, and that's a chronic problem. And then, of course, there are toxins like mercury, PCBs, heavy metals, that once they're in the water, they hang out forever. They get down into the sediment, and they're very difficult to clean up. So what do we want to do? What do we need to do if we want to get to those fishable and swimmable waters? So the first thing is we really, and this is difficult politically, but we have to confront the fact that agricultural runoff is really the leading cause of water pollution in the US today. I don't think that was true so much 50 years ago. Some of that is runoff of fertilizer from cropland, but an awful lot of it comes from the factory farms that we use to raise livestock. Those farms raise animals under contract to a handful of very large corporations. We need to make those corporations responsible for the problem. They need to assume some of the cost of keeping all the manure that these operations generate out of the waters, because that manure carries phosphorus, bacteria, and nitrogen, and creates problems across the US. The second thing, I think, and I just want to flag a failure to confront agriculture. That is probably the biggest program failure in the Clean Water Act. People talk about non-point sources when they talk about agriculture. Just want to remind everybody, in the law itself, it says these big animal feedlots where you've got lots and lots of animals confined in very small space, generating mountains of manure, are actually point sources that are supposed to have permits that limit their discharges. That just hasn't happened. And that is a big problem. That points to the need for more effective enforcement of the Clean Water Act. We need that everywhere. There are too many cases where a polluter will operate in violation of the law for a long, long time and nothing happens. Those minimum standards for treatment plants that I talked about, they were supposed to be tuned up and made more stringent every 5 years as technology improved. You could ask for more. That's not really happening. Two-thirds of the industries that are subject to those standards are operating under limits that were set more than 30 years ago. We know technology has improved since then. The standards need to be updated and reflect that. And if we did that, you'd see a lot lower pollution loads from those plants. We have to face new threats that weren't on the horizon 50 years ago. I think probably most people on this call have heard of PFAS and PFOA, chemicals used in Teflon and Scotchgard and other products. We found out recently those are everywhere. Those are pervasive in both drinking water and surface water. And we're going to need standards that force cleanup of that pollutant. Climate change is having a big impact on the health of our rivers and streams. I've already mentioned the overheating of waterways in Oregon. In the East Coast, we have the opposite problem. We get heavy, heavy rain coming. We get torrential downpours, really, in very short periods of time. That's driving a lot of pollution off of farm fields and city streets and into the water. So we need to get that problem under control. 50 years ago, we had the imagination and political will to face big problems and try to do something about them. We're hoping at this half century mark that we can find the courage to recommit to the Clean Water Act and make the hard decisions we need to make if we're ever going to get fishable and swimmable waters for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project and former Director of Civil Enforcement at EPA. Our next speaker is Bruce Resnick, R-E-Z-N-I-K, Executive Director of Los Angeles Waterkeeper. Go ahead, Bruce.
Good morning. As mentioned, Bruce Resnick. Good morning from California, at least. And I'm here to talk about the state of California waters, but also what's next. And I will try to cover what are, you know, immense water challenges in California in 3 minutes. A state that is home to 1 in 8 Americans, but also has a quarter of our land dedicated to agriculture, actually the largest agricultural state in terms of gross receipts. So I'm going to have to keep things at a pretty high level in to cover a state where the challenges are so so pronounced and varied. As already been pointed out by Eric, really where the Clean Water Act has been most successful in California is really ratcheting down in those large point sources, industrial wastewater facilities through the permitting system, through the massive investments that happened. I did want to highlight one other thing that I don't think has been mentioned. The Clean Water Act also included things known as citizen supervisions, which are really important to groups like LA Waterkeeper and other waterkeepers across the nation that allow communities to stand in the role of regulator and sue for clean water if our government agencies are not doing their job. And that has also had a huge impact on the health of waterways. And while I could provide, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of examples, the one I will mention is sewer spills, which was also a chronic problem throughout California in our cities and have been over the last 20 years reduced by over 90% because of litigation filed by groups like LA Waterkeeper, San Diego Casekeeper, and San Francisco Baykeeper. And in LA, for example, we averaged 2 sewer spills a day before we brought those suits. And so it is important at this half century mark to recognize the huge impact the Clean Water Act has had on the health of our waterways, but also to acknowledge the failures. And frankly, from California's perspective, it's hard to even say the promise of the Clean Water Act has been half kept, because in LA County, for example, which is what I know most working here, about 85% of our rivers, creeks, lakes, and shorelines that have been assessed don't meet Clean Water Act standards for any number of reasons, which have already been covered, from bacteria to heavy metals, pesticides, herbicides, plastics, oil, grease, and a host of deadly toxins like DDT and PCBs. And the number statewide is no better, where almost all of our state waterways, our rivers are around, I think, 82%, but almost every other type of waterway, we're over 90%. And it is urban and agricultural runoff that are now the leading sources. And I know a lot of our speakers are going to cover agricultural runoff. So I'll just mention in the urban setting, again, using LA County as an example, we have more than 100 billion gallons of untreated, because this does not go to the sewer system, untreated urban and stormwater runoff flows that carry all those different toxins I mentioned into our rivers, our creeks, our streams, our storm drain system, and ultimately into the ocean every year. And so what do we need to reverse these trends? You've heard about one is enforcement, but I will also mention that not only do our agencies need to do a better job enforcement, but even in environmentally friendly California, our agencies are actually making it harder for third-party groups like Waterkeeper to bring enforcement actions by weakening permits, delaying deadlines for things like TMDLs and other steps that actually make our job harder. As been pointed out, we need to modernize and strengthen the Clean Water Act and our federal laws to account for today's realities of urban and agricultural runoff, plastics, other kind of forever chemicals. I would also note a couple things just to highlight is the focusing more on ecological and biological health. In a place like LA, where frankly is the home of the concrete rivers, focusing more on ecology and not just on the chemical health is really crucial. And lastly, the water climate connection is so vital and has been talked about to some extent, but just to highlight, in California and in the West, our never-ending drought is really devastating the flows of our rivers throughout the region, but also our poor water planning is a driver of climate change. In California, the water sector is the number one user of electricity in the state, 20% of all electricity use. So smarter water planning that can be driven by federal regulation can actually help us address our code red climate emergency. And lastly, on the investment piece, which was pointed out, which is so critical, again, the federal infrastructure was a start, but just again, in LA County alone, we are going to need to invest $40 billion over the next 20 years to get clean water and water security. And so we need much, much more at the federal and state and local levels for investment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. From California, that was Bruce Resnick. executive director of Los Angeles Waterkeeper. But before we move to our next speaker, I'd like to highlight the presence today of Keene Kelderman. He's a research manager at the Environmental Integrity Project and an analyst who's been working on this report for more than a year, going through tens of thousands of pages of reports from all 50 states, looking at the most recent data that the states have submitted to EPA and crunching numbers for 50 states, a huge amount of research. Keene will be available for questions after our speakers make their presentations. Our next speaker is Fred Tutman, the Patuxent River Keeper. And Fred, go ahead.
He's speaking
from Maryland, yeah.
Appreciate that. So my name is Fred Tutman. I've been the Patuxent River Keeper for over 18 years. I'm also a Patuxent son, having lived next to the river I protect my entire life. I'm in my mid-60s now, and there's never been a time in my lifetime when the water quality in the Patuxent was either improving or even acceptable. There were literally times I can recall when not much grew near that river, and there was so much sewage and poisons in it that not much lived in it either. Things are slightly better now, but still way below par. Whatever progress we've made, it is truly insufficient to counterbalance the normalization of diminishing fisheries, increasing dead zones, and water that on some of our beaches can make you sick if you come into contact with it. People literally watch annual water quality scores like they watch the stock market, like it's some kind of voodoo or something. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. It's kind of like sticking your finger in the wind. That's really not a sign that we can expect significant improvements anytime soon. Actually, it's kind of tragic. So if clean water is a gold standard, then water is either, that's, you know, if you have water that's sort of clean or even a little bit clean, that's a sick joke. We don't get good grades for effort when it comes to protecting water. You either protect it or not. It's either clean or it's not. There's no in between. So with the reality that we have yet to clean up a single river in the Chesapeake Bay network of rivers, with all the meetings, promises, PowerPoint presentations, various multi-state bay agreements, both past and present, it's increasingly clear that the same stuff we've done for the past is just folly. It's not likely to produce the results we might like. I have to say the most glib rationale I've ever heard is a fellow who said to me once that we haven't totally failed at cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. We just have not succeeded to the extent that we might like. Pretty dreary. So too much aspirational thinking, positive thinking, not enough reality checks. The trend on most of these riverways or waterways is not on an incline towards meaningful improvement. So quite frankly, in many instances, the math behind water protection doesn't even work when you consider that not a single jurisdiction on my river is inclined to say no to a single permit application. The notion that you can keep adding fresh inputs, not retire any of them, not really do much enforcement, all while saying yes to every desirable project like constructions, permits, and whatever, it's clearly a form of liar's poker. We have to have the courage to admit when we're not succeeding. And so we need to double down, look at any number of possible ways forward as far as how we regulate, enforce, and treat our precious water generally. Most people I speak with these days have a low confidence that the state of local water is likely to be much better 10 years from now, based on the course we're presently on. So it's time to get real, time to get serious, double down on these problems that the Patuxent history shows have persisted for decades. It's time for radical new approaches, and frankly, ones that perform, not just ones that make everybody feel pretty good and pretty aspirational. So there it is. We got to get busy. Thank you.
From Maryland, that was Fred Tutman, the Patuxent River Keeper. And now from Louisiana, we have Dr. Brady Skaggs, S-K-A-G-G-S, the Water Quality Program Director for the Pontchartrain Conservancy. Go ahead, Dr. Skaggs.
Good afternoon from America's Wetland, where it is a fantastic place for both culture and seafood. I know everybody that comes here loves to rave about the quality of our food and our dishes, and that's true. For us, I think we have two primary concerns or two different ways that we could think about water. One is the Mississippi River. That is a very large watershed that's draining two-thirds of the continental U.S., and it impacts our fisheries by having a very large hypoxic or dead zone. I think that that's ultimately something that's going to require a substantial amount of ingenuity and collaboration between states, since these water problems don't observe state boundaries. And it's something that may require something as innovative or entrepreneurial as water quality credit trading. But for us as an organization, one of the things that we like to focus on are on-site wastewater treatment systems, which could be thought of as both septic systems and then a mechanical or aerated type of system, which we refer to as an aerated treatment unit. Outside of New Orleans or outside of Baton Rouge, the substantial amount of communities utilize these on-site wastewater treatment systems to treat and maintain their sanitary wastewater. It's all well and good. It's nice not to have to pump a gallon of water clear across the state or across the city to have it treated. But at the end of the day, in our project areas, we find that an overwhelming number of these systems are not functioning as they're intended to, nor are they chlorinated or disinfectant. So that is adversely impacting the measures that we have as far as swimmability with fecal coliform, enterococci, or other measures. So we work collaboratively with these different homeowners and different projects and areas. We track the data and look at improvements. And hopefully we, you know, have such an impact that we can have waterways delisted. I think to date, we've had 8 different waterways delisted for swimming impairments as a portion of doing this non-point source work, which has been fantastic. But that is not a static success. Just because something is delisted every 2 years doesn't mean it can't go back on the list. And so in some areas we have seen, like in the Yellow Water River area, those areas are back on the impaired waterways list. So there's certainly been a great number of successes in the Clean Water Act. We're still looking to try to address non-point source pollution where we can.
Thank you. From Louisiana, that was Dr. Brady Skaggs, the Water Quality Program Director for the Pontchartrain Conservancy. And now from Indiana, we have Dr. Indra Frank. She's the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. Go ahead, Dr. Frank.
Thank you, Tom. My home state of Indiana is a water-rich state. Our waters are decidedly better off as a result of the Federal Clean Water Act, but there are challenges that it has not addressed as well. Because of the Clean Water Act, Indiana has significantly reduced sewage and industrial waste going into our rivers and streams, and I'll use the Clean Water Act's impact on sewage as an example. In the 1990s, it became clear that many of Indiana's wastewater treatment plants weren't keeping up because the local pipes carried a combination of stormwater and wastewater to the plants. Indianapolis, which is my hometown, was among more than 100 communities in Indiana with one of these combined systems. And as a result, when there was more than just a quarter of an inch of precipitation, the treatment plant couldn't handle the volume, and it was allowed to overflow into the White River, carrying untreated sewage with it. In fact, Indianapolis had more than 5 billion gallons of combined sewer overflow per year. But because of a 2006 agreement under the Clean Water Act, that's now being addressed. The agreement led to an infrastructure project that will soon control 97% of the overflows. So that reduced sewage going into the White River is a clear example of a benefit from the Clean Water Act. Now I'll shift to the challenges the Clean Water Act has not addressed. The most significant for Indiana is the loophole for agricultural runoff and other non-point source pollution. The law has mechanisms to deal with point sources, like pipes that discharge pollutants, but runoff and non-point sources were left to mainly voluntary measures. In Indiana, we've had decades of these voluntary measures, and it has included encouraging and even paying farmers to adopt measures that reduce runoff. There's a limit to how much can be accomplished by these voluntary programs. For example, the percent of Indiana cropland using no-till remained essentially unchanged from 2005 to 2019 at 38%. And the percent of Indiana cropland using cover crops was only 10% in 2015 and actually dropped to 8% in 2019. So the voluntary measures haven't solved the problem. E. coli bacteria still impair 73% of Indiana's assessed waterways, and nutrient pollution from runoff has led to increasing numbers of harmful algal blooms. Unlike runoff and non-point sources of pollution, the point sources are regulated under the Clean Water Act and have to have permits to discharge, but those discharge permits need to be stronger. For example, Indiana has been able to twist the existing provisions of the Clean Water Act in a way that allows coal ash contaminated groundwater to be discharged directly into the adjacent river. And that discharge to the river is actually being proposed as a solution for the groundwater contamination by the coal ash. So Indiana has benefited from the Clean Water Act, but more is needed going forward.
From Indiana, that was Dr. Indra Frank of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Now we go to Iowa, where we have Alicia Basto, the Water Program Associate Director for the Iowa Environmental Council. Go ahead, Alicia.
Thanks, Tom, and hello, everyone.